Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an X-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Ed.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Sharon.
And today on the show, we are covering season 4, episode 18, Gut Reaction. But first, how are you all doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah. It's all right. Yeah, survived Eunice, which was blowing everything and everyone apart here.
We had a last little survivor of Eunice here this afternoon because it was just like, here's a year's worth of rainfall in 2 minutes. All right then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But survived, so feeling grateful for that, because it was, I did have to go out in it, and all the weather reports and news reports were like, don't go out, and I was like, my hospital appointment, and I phoned them and said, are you cancelling? And they said no, so I had to get there.
Fair play.
Which was interesting, but there you go. I just put the umbrella up and did a Mary Poppins. The wind took me there, so it was fine.
Yeah. Did you land with that same kind of stately grace?
I did, because that is how
it was. The wrong hospital, but
absolutely, yeah.
Blown you off completely,
In Barnsley, but
do the appointment here. Do you know who I am?
We must get the manufacturer of your umbrella, because we need to get them to put the roof on the O2.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So brilliant British weather conversation there. So you might have noticed on our socials a little bit and in other places that. Oh my God, Judy Boulay's name has gone on my head.
Gloria Boulay?
Gloria Boulay.
We did it in stages. That's
we
all right.
Did.
That's
what we're
here
for.
We'll be fine when we get it. So Gloria Rubin is reuniting with Eric LaSalle on a Hallmark movie.
Yeah, great.
So cute.
Hopefully this time we get a happy ending.
Please.
let the ER writers not hear about this and be like, wait, give us the script.
Season 16. And also, Gloria Rubin is in the new Stephen King film Firestarter. Thank you. Can somebody do the words?
Hey, you're bringing us to where we need to be. Look, we'll do the details. Don't worry about that. You're exactly. Getting the story, but
you're getting there. Yeah.
Thanks for that. And also, Anthony Edwards got his name right, who played Dr. Mark Kovach. Dr. Mark Green. It's also going to be in Tales of the Walking Dead, which is yet another Walking Dead spin-off. Oh. I'll probably watch that one just because it's him, but I'm a little bit jaded with Walking Dead right now.
I think he's in The Inventing Anna, which is something I just started on Netflix. I think.
Oh, yeah.
I saw his name on something. I was doing an IMDb about something else. I thought I saw his name, but I have been IMDbing a lot of shows recently, so please don't hold me to that. But I think he might possibly be. And we always love it when we see ER alums. I've been watching Gossip Girl, and I completely forgot, but Cleo is in that, and she turns up.
Oh, nice.
And I was just like,
Michael Michelle?
Yes, yeah. And I was like, there she is. So, yeah.
She's
we do
gorgeous.
Love seeing her. Yeah. Oh, gosh, she's stunning. And she's perfect for Gossip Girl because she fits in with their whole, we're all stunning. But
okay. Does she play a nasty character, or is she quite a bitchy character or a nice person?
She starts out nice and then it goes downhill, unfortunately. But okay. I think that's just what I think sometimes the feelings I get when I watch that show is that they don't always know what their plan is, and they kind of start somewhere and then go, oh, now we want to do something, and they'll turn somebody evil or whatever. But... I mean, it makes sense for her character in the industry she works in. I can imagine maybe she's nice at the beginning and changes, but just sometimes it feels a bit like they go down one path and go, hang on, reverse. But that's not what we're here to talk about, are we?
No.
I'm not here to talk about
okay. All right. I was going to go into full Michael Michelle. I haven't seen her in enough things, but anyway. So season 4, episode 18, Gut Reaction. What do we think of the episode?
I had a gut reaction to the episode.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. No, I liked it. I really liked it. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen, and it kind of sets up for a lot of other things to start. It's got that lovely kind of element of comedy in this that runs throughout this one because of Mark and the banquet and how hopeless he's going to be. And then we have one of those lovely, everybody's happy from the ER moments where they're all singing and dancing. And
I love that.
I love those. So I was like, yep, I'm in. This is exactly what I like.
I got the feeling with this. It's funny because I think we're, what, 5 episodes left to go in the season.
Yeah.
And I remember I was watching going like, this is a lot of pins to be setting up for not an awful lot of time left, but of course it's it's not like the show was about to finish after season four.
That's but true.
What I'm getting a lot as well is, and I don't know, maybe here I am just taking over, but I thought we've seen the complete downfall of Morgenstern, and we're seeing a lot more of Romano.
Yes. It feels like they're setting us up, aren't they, for the switch of these two characters. And
Definite tonal shift between the two. Morgenstern is a nice guy. He was largely inoffensive, a little bit eccentric, but just sort of bubbled along the background. And if they needed somebody to be the authority, and Kerry was, do you know what I mean? It was just that Romano's got his own agendas, he's got his own approach. But it drives so much brilliant drama, and so it drives more storyline with his character than Morgenstern ever really did.
Yeah, and I have to say, the past few episodes, I've realised how boring I find Morgenstern as a character.
A little bit.
I feel like what they've done, you know, that doesn't work for me, is that they didn't ever really introduce him enough for us to care about the stuff that comes later on. Although he's dressed up as the Catholic schoolgirl. No, he wasn't. But, you know, there were those moments of kind of like little bits. But then all of a sudden we're supposed to kind of really care about the fact that he's kind of deteriorating, which I found I don't. But that's a personal opinion.
Yeah, I think he... William H. Macy, lovely man. Love him to it. I really hope that statement doesn't age badly.
But, I mean, his wife was involved in that horrible
scandal. Oh, the college scandal.
And I imagine he must, he can't have been unknowing to that. So for me, it puts a tiny black mark on him, but
That is, you're 100%. Okay, right. William H. Macy is a person.
I'm sure he's a great man, but, there's,
But I think I always got the feeling, and I'd love to see what you, I always got the feeling that he was in a different show to everyone else.
Oh, okay.
He was the way that he kind of goes on. And,
It
felt like he should be in the country in a practice where, I don't know if I don't think either of you ever saw Everwood, but that to me is like this drama that he probably would do. That's what I first knew Chris Pratt from. I think that was his first big kind of show. But it was about kind of like this kind of small town and I imagine this eccentric doctor to be in something like that and kind of being a bit more philosophical the way, Morgenstern is rather than... I think that's what it is. Everything about ER is like fast, fast, fast. And of course, we like our moments when it slows and gives us a break. But Morgenstern just felt like a snooze. It was just like he just, to me, doesn't fit in this show, like you say.
On that note, should we start with Morgenstern and Benton?
Yeah. I like this, because, wow.
Swanee comes in, old Swanson. Has a swan song.
Oh!
Well played.
God, you are on fire today. He managed to self-diagnose while he's on the table because he's the guy, basically.
He's a pathologist and he's a doctor. And they don't know this at the beginning, do they? Corday and Benton are just kind of called down to try and treat this guy, diagnose him, and he kind of diagnoses himself. And it's only when Morgenstern comes in and he's like, oh, hi, Swanee, we learn, this guy was this teacher and he actually taught Morgenstern and loved Morgenstern.
I just thought of a terrible joke. Bad.
Go on.
He's a pathologist, so did he come in as a mystery shopper for the pathology department?
I mean, that is commitment. That is commitment.
Oh my
God. He died doing what he loved.
He literally did.
This will be a good teaching case. Come on, kids.
I mean, are you a real doctor if you don't do that? That's commitment.
Well, put yourself there it is.
There for science.
Yeah. I just need a minute now. So it turns out that Swanson, he's got these various medical issues. He said he had a hernia that he should have sorted out years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns out that he needs to remove his entire stomach.
Ow.
Like, this is perhaps, I mean, is this a case of remove it and put an artificial one in, or is it, do you then have to go on? I know a colostomy obviously is a different system, but something similar to that. I mean, I kind of think like we kind of need our stomach to live.
Yeah, I wish I kind of, on a medical knowledge standpoint, would have liked to have known what happens next, because That is, to me, is quite fascinating. Well, that's fascinating to me, you know. Is there a way that people live without them? Do they have to stay on a strict liquid diet? Do they get nutrients elsewhere? I don't know. But yeah, it's fascinating. But yeah, he's quite unwell, really. He's got a few things going on. And Morgenstern kind of comes down and is, you know, being Morgenstern. And Dr. Swanson says to him, can you do it laparoscopically, the procedure they need to do? And Corday is very against this. And you get the sense Benton is too, but when Morgenstern asks Benton, Benton's very much like, yep, whatever you think you need to do, I think you know best, kind of, you know, respectful. And also, I think, with the hope of being able to see the procedure happen. But of course, Morgenstern says, nope, I'm taking Corday because she's against this and I want to prove her wrong, which, you know, is quite, you know, I mean, that for me is a good on Morgenstern. You know, he doesn't need yes men around him. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that because he presents himself, although he does and he doesn't, but he presents himself as a bit of a weed, a bit of a yes man, a bit of a like, let's all be friends in the room. But then it's like, oh, no. There's obviously, he obviously became chief of emergency medicine for a reason.
Yes.
We get to see those, which you do need to provide. Otherwise, it's like The Office, you know, they will say with the American Office, they had to have moments where Michael Scott could do the job well. So you understood why he had been picked and you kind of go, oh, okay, he actually is. There are moments of real competence and
they,
I think it's
shift
similar
that later on, I feel like, in that show, I feel
they always had moments. I think the first season they hadn't found their footing yet, and it was very much everybody was just laughing at him all the time. But I think as it went on, they realized actually you kind of need people to be on his side in some ways, and then that shift, I think, was a big difference and what made it, I think, very like more successful for me than the British one. But that's,
I think, having not watched it, I haven't watched either. I'm aware of them. I know who the characters, that kind of just pop culture. I think the American one is now generally more popular or better regarded, but I suppose there's only X amount of episodes of the British one.
I think it is. I think there was a real time, especially when it first came out, where people, especially like British fans, were very against the Americans doing it. Yeah. And, you know, I get why, but I think you're right. I think people have gone, actually, they're two very, very different beasts, and these are the brilliant things. And I just feel like the British Office hasn't aged as well as the American one. And there's a lot happening in the American one that people just love it for, and more iconic than I think the British one ever. I think it has its place, but I think it has, the tide turned.
I don't think it, and this might be my opinion. We will get back to ER in a minute, listeners, honest, but
never.
We do love The Office too. This has become The Office podcast.
The Office, Gossip Girl, anything else? Yeah.
Ricky Gervais himself is a controversial figure and is very Marmite-y. I don't have a lot of time for him personally.
Same.
And so to me, he's got that... I don't want to say stink, but he's got that stink around him, and so does The Office and other of his projects. Like, I did like Extras, but then subsequent stuff, I was just like, I just don't want to see him.
Same here.
I'm not that bothered.
I'm the same.
Morgenstern.
But yeah, so Morgenstern is competent, and we kind of get to see that he wants to take Corday in. We get that really interesting, you know, we've had a couple of moments where Corday is talking to Benton about how she just doesn't, you know, really understand the Morgenstern appeal, because she's talking about the short leash that Romano has her on, and Benton's very much, oh, you know, maybe you should get Morgenstern to kind of sponsor you. And she's a bit like, I don't get it. It's a bit like, why is everybody loving this person? It's a bit like, to quote a whole other show again, you know, Ben Wyatt and the whole Little Sebastian. He just doesn't get Little Sebastian, and everybody's obsessed with Little Sebastian and he doesn't get it. And I feel like it's a similar, like Corday's just really like, why are you all obsessed with Morgenstern? Like, from what I've seen, well, she says she's not comfortable with him, which, you know, it's quite a big statement.
She's only seen him last week. She's not heard about him because he's been out of action for so long.
Doesn't that tell you something? You haven't heard about him. Yeah. She's like, that who? Do you know what I mean? Like, you feel like if somebody's away and they're great and brilliant and really effective and really, people would talk more about you. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Romano had a buzz around him to begin with, within the confines of the show.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, Romano was doing great things. Rocket Man. can't do any more of that because Elton will sue me. Again.
Yes, come on, like, Jesus. Can you afford another times? Elton John lawsuit?
Obsessed with me. So it's funny when Benson was talking to Corday and she gives him that epic side eye about maybe you could get, you know, sponsored by Morgenstern. It's like that. Who?
Yeah.
She was just, oh, I could always go back and go to the Gloucestershire Royal Hospital. I just felt like, and I've just double checked, that's what I was doing a minute ago, that it's one of those things where the Americans just stick royal and the name of a county or a name of like the London Royal or the Queen's Royal or the Queen's Gloucestershire. The thing is, the Gloucestershire Royal Hospital exists in Gloucester.
It does.
Which is really annoying because it doesn't fit into my thing of dissing American writers. But at the same time, it's a long way. She was based in London. Now she's going to go work in Gloucestershire. It's not that close. I mean, by American terms, it's a cab ride, but I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I was a bit like, oh, okay, they're getting specific about things. And
yeah.
I'm not in the medical profession, but I feel like there's something about London maybe being the place to be if you're, you know, kind of up to date. You know, kind of modern advances. I don't know, that's very general, but the Gloucester, that hospital does exist. But I do, there is something that the ER staff, I don't know how much they did it, but they would do, if they had somebody from another country, they would ask them questions about to try and get some authenticity. Like, I know for a fact Goran got to pick his name because he was given a list and he got to choose actually what his name is. And
a lot of his backstory came into Lucas, didn't it? There was a lot of overlap.
I don't know about that, but I just know a lot of the, I think when they had people from other places, they would sometimes say to them, you know.
Fair enough.
I cannot for the life of me think of where it's from, but I know a similar story revolves around an Asian actor was hired to play an Asian character, and they're able to say, actually, you've given me a Chinese name, but you've written the character as Korean. And they were able to, you know, kind of like, the intention was okay, but the execution needs a lot more work.
Yeah.
I want to go, is that Star Trek? But I don't think it's Star Trek, even though it's the first place where my mind always goes to, because they have,
strange,
you know. I know, right? Yeah.
It would happen a lot in The Bill. I always remember there was this thing, a lot of Indian people I knew who worked on The Bill would talk about it, and they'd be like, oh, we were once hired for The Bill and the mom had a Muslim name, the one kid had a Sikh name, the other kid had a Hindu name.
Oh, and, dear Lord.
Yeah, gosh, and I think it's just that not actually asking the questions or not going, actually, we're not the experts in this room. Could you help? And that's, again, you know, diversifying rooms, isn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, so we kind of have that. Corday's just not sure. And I also really like it in that moment where when they're scrubbing in and she says to Benton, she's talking to Benton about him. And Benton says, you do this, you know, you kind of, when you get, you know, when you feel nervous about something, you start attacking the attendees, which she was like, do I? Which I thought was just a cute little observation that he's made of kind of, you know, he's paying attention, which I thought there was a cute little hint at that.
Yeah, he really knows her pretty damn well. But I mean, the intimation is that while they're not actually in a relationship, they practically are partners in a lot of the ways.
Yeah, yeah. And then she switches with him, so he gets to kind of go into the room. But we do get have that scene with Morgenstern and Weaver, don't we, where you start to see how actually, because before he was very confident, we can do it laparoscopically, whatever, swaddy, you know, finger guns at everybody. And then actually in the privacy of his own office, he's watching an old procedure that he did of this procedure, but like an old one, so he can kind of maybe relearn the technique, maybe familiarize himself. And then Weaver kind of finds him doing that and is all like, oh yeah, it's always good to look at it. But he comes across as really unsure in that scene. And I think because Weaver's somebody he feels able to be like that with, maybe he shows his vulnerability in that moment.
Does definitely. And he gets into the OR and, you know, he's pally with Shirley. He knows it. Oh, he's still collecting 45s. And she's so, if you contrast that the way she talks to Benson later on, which is a little bit frosty, she's so glad to see him, and it does make a difference when a manager or somebody above you knows about you personally.
Yeah,
you're not just another, you know, carbon blob. Mm. You are.
You're not a number. You're not just a, exactly, you know, yeah, a cog in the machine. You're actually important, yeah, and a person. And,
exactly.
And you see that goodwill that everybody has. And you see, again, yeah, you know, moments of why he kind of ended up being the chief, you know, and he's all, and he's back to his eccentricity, the way he set up the room is a bit differently. And he wants his Peruvian panpipes, which he assures Benton he will love. I don't,
yeah,
believe that that would be Benton's first choice.
Such a nice cliche, Peruvian panpipes.
You know, I was going to say, what was it? Everybody was obsessed with panpipes, weren't they, in the 90s?
I remember we did in school, we had, it both was and wasn't, a Catholic school that I went to, in terms of it wasn't in any way owned by or operated by.
Okay.
Yet we had a rectory. We had a room set aside for it. And, but anyway, sorry, that we would do every so often guided meditation. And so, like, whenever I think of panpipes, I think of just being real chill in my school uniform.
Oh, cool.
So I have to say, for me, it's a positive memory. Now, I must say, I didn't have any horror stories.
Panpipe horror stories.
I didn't have Peter Pan kicking the door and stealing my children. Like,
let's Panpipe horror stories has got to be a band name. Sorry, I've got it.
Oh man, you've called it. Damn it, you've called it. Yeah,
he has. So yeah, so that's kind of how it starts, and then we see them actually in the procedure, and Morgenstern starts lashing out at Benton, and Benton's like, no, I'm not where you say I am, yeah, you need to do this, and he's not listening, and he's
sweating as well, so he's going to turn the thermostat down.
Yeah, and Ben starts to get a bit concerned when he says that. He's a bit like, oh, and then, you know, he's not where he says he is, and he's kind of lashing out Benton, and then Swanee starts to, you know, he dies, doesn't he, and they have to try, that, you know, he starts crashing, and they're having to try and figure out how to do it, and Morgenstern's going, no, it's all you're doing things wrong, you know, just not picking up on the fact that actually he probably needs to put his hands up and say, I need to step out or step away, or somebody else needs to take control, because I don't really know what's happening. And then Benton does that thing where he pushes him out the way, which becomes a really defining moment from this episode, isn't it? And I think what it is as well for me in this moment is Benton is so good at his job, and he so wants to do the right for the patient, that this is what happens to him. He becomes so kind of laser focused on that, rather than, you know, what he should be like in the room, and should he push Morgenstern out the way, what are the implications. He's just like, no, I've got to save this guy, and or give it my all at least. But yeah, I think everybody in the room is quite shocked of that Benton did that. And we know it's going to have repercussions, don't we? So it's a bit of a tough watch, because I'm a huge Benton fan. And
yeah,
like, I hate saying this phrase, but Romano is right at the end, even though I think we all agree Peter did the right thing, although the patient still died. I think he did the right thing at the moment. But as Romano says, end of the day, you're a resident, he's the chief. Yeah. So if it comes down to word versus word, Benton really hasn't a hope.
Yeah. And that's what's horrible, isn't it? Because the next scene we see is Benton's actually at the morgue, he's gone down to before the autopsy is performed, he's gone down to find out when it is. And you know, the lady's very much like, oh, I don't know what they're called, the morgue lady. I don't know what her name would be. The pathologist, I guess.
Yeah.
I saw she'd be the pathologist. Technically, no, she wouldn't be the undertaker. Pathologist. Pathologist. So, I love that actor. I know we've talked about her before. Megan Cole, her way of delivering.
That's why I was clicking. Sorry, but I had to remind myself. It's a voice. It's
the
voice.
It's everything. Her presence, her voice, the way. I just really believe her to be a pathologist. Like, she just is to me. And, you know, she points out how unusual this is, that he would want to be there, and that he wants to know when it's happening. And then Anspar comes down as well. So it's even more like, gosh, you know, this is a huge deal. And Anspar's actually like trying to talk to Benton, because he says, I heard there was something happen, but Morgenstern is playing it down.
Mm.
And Benton doesn't give much away, but Anspar says to him, oh, you can get the tape, you know, and look at that, which is a huge revelation for Benton, because that basically will be the thing that will show he was actually in the right.
it'll exonerate him completely, and it'll also put Morgenstern in a bad light as well.
Yeah. So he goes to find that, and as we say, you know, frosty reception, and he goes to one of those, you know, I love those TV tower things, those little wheelie trolleys, because they used to signal good times at school, didn't they? Yeah, they would get wheeled in.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like, you're going to watch a film. Oh, yeah. It's a documentary.
Oh, yeah, our teacher's hungover. We're watching TV today.
End of term, that gets wheeled in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the tape is not there, so maybe it wasn't made. So that's not great news. But Anspaw's also put Benton in charge of kind of the investigation into it, to gather all the documents and stuff. And I thought that was interesting. I wondered if Anspaw, I don't know, does Anspaw suspect something? Like, he's putting a lot of kind of trust in Benton rather than being like, you did something wrong. And it made me think, you know, what does he know, or does he suspect? I don't know.
Because I suppose in a general sense, with Anspaw being, you know, he's the chief admin guy of the hospital. You know, this guy who's been missing for months comes back in and suddenly there's a dead patient.
Yeah.
I'm sure that has to raise an eyebrow. Even if it's just an eyebrow, that has to be like, it's not like, in all fairness, it's not like Romano, who's been in here every day for the last however many months, you know, with enough recent successes under his belt. There's a thing a boss said to me a long time ago. I remember it used to frustrate the crap out of me because it's so true. It's, you're only ever as good as your last job. And it's very grim. It can be very grim, I know. But if it's, because, you know, somebody leaving in disgrace, doesn't matter the 20 years of success they had before that. I'm not saying you should get away with one kill, but you know.
You have, so you don't know why you're...
Well, that's what it is, yeah. That's why every time I record this is from a different location.
Yeah.
This could be from sunny Peru.
Absolutely, as I am bathed in sunlight, as we know that Storm Eunice is doing their thing throughout the world. Like,
it feels really... It just feels like a lot is against Benton. And there's this great scene with, you know, between him and Romano, as you say, you know, Romano's like, you've got to get your you know, ducks in a row. And also Romano's not like, it was you. He's very much like, I don't know what happened. Maybe he knows more about Benton because he's worked up close with Benton a lot more. I don't know. But he's very much, he doesn't ever say, you did something wrong, I'm on Morgenstern's side. He just says, unfortunately, the facts of the case are that he is the attending and you aren't. And then we get this lovely scene between Benton and Corday, which I really like, where, you know, he's like, I know I wasn't there. It wasn't me, really. I just know 100%. And then he starts doubting himself. And she says, don't do that. You know it wasn't you. You just said that. Which I think is so natural. You know, when somebody, you're working with somebody more experienced and they make a mistake, you start believing it's you because you think they can't, you know. And I think because everybody else is kind of saying that to him as well, it's easy for him to start. But she's there, Corday's like, I will make a, you know, I will raise my concerns. And, it wasn't you, basically, which I feel like, you know, Benton really needs that at that moment. And also it crystallises this support and just their relationship and partnership and friendship and, you know, whatever the ships you could throw at them, that's what this, like, for me is. But sorry, before I move away from all that, I really loved the scene with him and Romano because it was just so beautifully shot with the umbrella and all the rain.
Yeah.
I just loved that. The silhouette of them was just so pretty. But
actually, agreeing with you completely there, as opposed to, here I am disagreeing. No, agreeing with you completely there. One thing that I think, a show that's set in Chicago, they managed to make the work. I know it's not always filmed in Chicago, but they managed to make the weather work more or less around what they need it for. Like, it becomes a part of the story. Because I'm sure you'd just be like, listen, if you're going to set a story at wintertime in Chicago, you need to feature some snow in this story.
You need a blizzard at least.
Yeah. And you're right. We get some beautiful shots out of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also from season one right through to the end, I've always thought whoever designed that car park never factored the amount of flooding that must happen because they're always ankle deep in water. Always. They not just go and just dig a hole in the middle of the ambulance bay.
Yeah, absolutely. But it feels like the beginning of the end for Morgan Stern here. You know, we have this really uncomfortable scene where he kind of really comes for Ben. Well, he starts out quite like, you know, I'm going to be very professional and we're just going to talk about the facts. And then he really starts coming for him, which, you know, he does that turn, which is quite nasty, and starts really saying, you know, it was you, and it, you know, and acting like he is going to use the fact that of who he is against him. And Benton talks to him about the VCR and said, no, there's no tape. There's no tape. I didn't tape it, which I know later we find out is not the case, but not in this episode, but later. But at this point, I can see a man fighting for his life and I can see a man panicking, but I also wonder how aware he is. Does he know it really was him, or is he still a bit on the fence? I mean, the fact that the tape goes missing makes me think he must know.
There's a couple of seconds in this where I would believe him. Morgan Stern's a good guy. Morgan Stern's Jeremy, he's a good guy when he says, oh, look, I didn't tape it. I'm more kind of felt, ah, damn it. You know, ah, damn it. But then you're kind of like, no, that's a wee bit convenient. And especially he kind of took this immediately. All right, Peter, I'm willing to defend you. You know, I'll use
it. Yeah.
Because he knows full well what he's doing. He has the credibility and standing that if he deflects all of the blame onto Peter, he can still probably protect Peter. And I do believe that he's actually coming at it from, let's get all of our names out of the mud here. Whereas if it goes onto him, nobody else there would be able to say, don't worry, listen, this or that or whichever. It's like, no, the chief of emergency medicine oomped up during a surgery.
Mm-hmm. It must be difficult. And they do talk about this, a few instances of this kind of storyline of when you're a doctor and you get past being able to, the struggle of getting past the point where you're actually being a good doctor and you're actually starting to endanger lives, and the difficulty of letting go of the fact that you were a doctor and that was your life's work. And now all of a sudden, you can't do that job, and that kind of struggle, which is also kind of what Morgan Stern, I guess, is going through.
Yeah, it's going to crop up in a very nasty way in a future season with a friend of Kerry's, one of the all-time top Ibers. But it's can't be easy. So any more to say on that? I think we've covered
that. I think that's
well. Yeah.
So where do we want to go next? Do you go Mark and these horrendous banquet preparations Jerry comes with? It is a bit lighter.
And Jerry. It is
definitely,
Let's go with it.
Let's go with it. But I just love that I love this whole storyline because it unfolds all the way throughout. It's like kind of little scenes and little moments. But, you know, everybody's just concerned because it's like, Mark is like, yeah, I'm doing it. And they're all like, are you going to be okay? And he's like, that's all right, I've got Jerry. And you think it'd be different if he said, it's okay, I've got Randy, or I've got...
Oh, Randy would get it.
Probably sorted. Anybody else. But the fact that he's got Jerry just makes me go, oh gosh, this is not going to end well. Like, I feel like everybody knows where it's going to end. Because it starts off with Carol being very much like, do you need any help? And being quite concerned. And he's like, oh, I've got it all sorted. And then they talk about the food. And it turns out, you know, and everybody's like, oh, hope it's not a buffet. And then Jerry jumps in and says, no, it's a smorgasbord, which to me is a buffet, isn't it? Isn't it like a Swedish?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
which I thought was really funny. Because as the episode goes on, we learn more and more, don't we? You know, he's like, the caterer is Swedish, they're doing a buffet. The caterer turns out to be his mom, which he did not say in the beginning, you know.
She's gonna make a big tub of borscht.
We see the disasters throughout the day. You know, they don't have a band because Jerry forgot to tell Green that he needed to pay the deposit. The flowers end up being delivered to the ER because they couldn't go, and they're horrible. They just look so like a little, like what you might do for a kid's, you know, with the plastic. It's got like plastic stethoscopes in it. It's as Chuni says, it's tacky. And the flowers are hideous and ugly. So
they are a bit.
I just love that Mark doesn't get that at all. Like, he hasn't come at it from kind of a, I'm doing this in a cheeky, ironic. He's like, really thinks they look good, which
I thought they were great. Yeah.
Does not bode well, does it? Anyway, it's all right. Band sorted. He's hired the machine. It's great.
They're a great band, apparently.
Sound like a great band.
He got a discount because Florence wasn't available.
Exactly. She's the big bucks. So the machine gets booked, and We turn up at the hotel. I mean, this isn't his fault, not the hotel, the Shangri Lodge, which sounds horrible. And it's not his fault about the weather, but, you know, there's a huge storm and everybody's kind of coming in completely wet and not happy. Jerry's got his blue tuxedo on. What did we all think of that?
I hate those ruffles, and you see them so much in American shows where somebody's like all decked out for the prom in their tux. Yeah. It's like powder blue with those horrific ruffles.
I'm I don't get that look. Good.
Isn't this the exact tuxedo that Homer Simpson wore to his prom?
Yes.
Like, it is. That is brilliant. I love that. Because you're right, it's such a period piece. I think I remember in Brian De Palma's film version of Carrie that half of the boys attending the prom were wearing this or a variation of tux. So I wonder, is this Jerry? So let's say Jerry's in his 30s.
Yeah.
So end of the 90s. He's in his 20s, end of the 80s. So yeah, early 80s, we could say maybe prom time. And oh, wow. Okay. I've just aged myself because I'm in my early 30s and it's mid. 16. Yeah, early. I haven't quite hit 34 yet, Edward. Next weekend. All right. Yeah, I'm in my mid 30s. There's no question of that. But yeah, I'm what, like 16 years out of since my, we call it the Debs, or the, you know, the final, the prom or the form or whatever. It's like, yeah, okay, so it's 16 years before, I think this is 97. I was like, okay, it's like 1981. This is very much the style of the of this would have been Jerry's prom, literal prom tuxedo.
Yeah. And more often than not. Prom was
24 years ago, so don't feel too bad.
I never got a prom because we weren't allowed. Well, we never called it proms at the time, but we used to call it like the like end of year dance or like the end of year kind of party or whatever. But a few years before I finished secondary school, when they were having the party, the people, the leavers at the time, one guy got so drunk he had to have his stomach pumped, and another few got like really tipsy, and we were told we weren't allowed to have one. And it was like, I'm sorry, we have to suffer because you guys didn't control the boys.
Not fair.
No, but thank also, you
24 years, man, the playlist for your prom must have been amazing, Ed.
Elton John.
I can't remember. Don't mention him to me.
ABBA. Who else is bigger than Stravay at that time? Bit of Queen.
24, not 54.
Chopin. A little bit Beethoven. Of Beethoven.
Yeah. Okay, moving on.
Yes. So I also think with this, you know, that tuxedo often does get used again, but always on kind of quirky characters or a bit of a losery character. So I think it was a bit of a nod to that, maybe. I don't know. You know, and then we get there to the banquet. You know, it's got moose's heads on the wall. Who, that's festive. Who does not want that? What I love is that they need drink tickets and he didn't tell them. And also, I don't really know how many drink tickets they get because he's just handing like one out here and there. And I'm thinking, I don't know, it just does not seem like the best party if you're handing out drink tickets to people.
It reminds me of too many lame work functions where I got, exactly. You promised two, but then one of your managers would give you a few more.
Yeah.
But it still was just a bit lame.
But it's all right because the machine is here. The machine turns up, gonna save everything. The machine is a man. The machine is one man.
And actually, you know,
I love it. I thought he was
really good. Kerry was very mean this program. The music is terrible. I think, considering the way it panned out, Mark put this whole thing together in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think it came out okay.
I have to say, I want to hire the machine for my wedding because I just think he's just fun. And everybody had a good time. They're all singing That's Amore by the end.
Which Doug starts,
and they're all drunk something, and they must have definitely had a few more tickets.
Yeah.
They must have stolen from.
I bet Carrie, you had a few.
But the food's not great, is it? Because
it doesn't sound great.
The meatballs are frozen or cold at least.
Yeah, and a lot of herring.
Yeah.
Never had herring. I'm sure it's lovely, but it doesn't sound appetizing.
It's definitely like I've been lucky enough that I've been to Norway, and it sounds like something I would just be eating at a buffet in Norway. It was horrendously expensive. Please dial those expectations way down. No, hang on, I need to be fair. Expectations, put them way up. Norway is incredible, but save for about 2 years first.
Okay.
But yeah, at that kind of buffet, you're just like, Yeah, yeah, this is this episode of ER. That's what this is.
Yeah, Mark does do a speech, though. We get a speech from him, which is cute. He says they're all family. He does make it about himself, though, and it's supposed to be a banquet celebrating all of them, and he turns up and says, you know, we're all family, which is a great way to start on this, and thank you for supporting me through my tough year, and everybody's like, woohoo! But I was a bit like, all right, Mark, we get it. And, you know, they're all dancing and laughing and singing by the end, so I imagine... It's one of those moments where you look back and you're like, God, everything went wrong, but it was brilliant. Like, not a disaster, everything went wrong.
But sometimes those ones where everything does go wrong, but you have a fun time, are even better than the ones, that, you know, the nights that go smoothly.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Because they're just a bit boring and, yeah, it's fun and we got, you know, hammered. And I look, by the way, when, it's Connie and Lydia were talking earlier on.
And about their dresses.
Oh, the velvet dress. Oh, you wore that last year, yeah, but at least, you know, I didn't pass out and tear mine in the car park afterwards. It was like, go on.
Yeah, it's like, oh, God.
It's a raucous night. It's not a, it sounds like, you know, everybody gets quite, you know, drunk and has fun.
Some drugs going around because Anna's high on Percodan.
Bloody she right is. She is.
I'm sure she should be.
Yeah.
There's a cool little thing, tiny, tiny little thing, that I know someone who's in this scene.
Oh!
Yes, a buddy of ours.
You know Maria Bella?
I am, in fact, close personal friends with her assistant's dog walker. a friend of the podcast, Heath Caster, is, in fact, an extra in the Conga line.
Wow.
How cool is that?
It's a little bit... Yes. Hello, Heath. Thank you very much. Yes, I told him that this episode was coming up and he was like, oh, I'm in the scene. So he's in the conga line. So I just wanted to give, often do we get to do that? So hello, Heath. It was lovely watching you on TV today.
Good job. You look like you had fun.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope you got some more drink tokens.
Yeah.
Yes, he said many things which I cannot repeat on air. I mean, that thing you said about Juliana Margulies, Heath, I mean, that doesn't bear repeating. But the rest of it is all very lovely. And by all accounts, it was a lot of fun to film this scene.
It looks like it. I'm glad it is.
Yeah, I'd rather do one of those scenes than a big, like, be an extra in kind of the trauma room of a sad death scene or something.
Or you know? Be the person on there because you just have to lie there, intubated intubated.
I'd be happy to just lie there.
Fiddling around in your gut or pretend guts.
Or even to be the doctor, just to destroy everyone's smiles. Or even to be the doctor that says, I don't understand why these parents can't just let these kids go.
Oh, yes. Do you want to turn to Jeannie next, do you think?
I want to get this out of the way because it's such a horrible one.
It is hideous, yeah. So, nobody wants to start this,
no.
Well, we find Scotty in the hospital. He is in one of those kind of isolation rooms because obviously he's so immunocompromised. He has to be kept completely sterile and kind of on his own. Really 90s, he's listening to Good Riddance, Time of Your Life by Green Day.
Yeah. It was Green Day, I couldn't remember for a bit.
And he's singing along and Jeannie comes in and he kind of says, oh, no, stop. And I love this because this is so what I used to be like, you know, there'd be parts of music, you'd be like, everybody has to just stop because I have to hear this part. It's so good. He does that. And then they both sing along and it's just.
She's got a great voice too.
She's got a brilliant voice and it's just really lovely. A lovely moment, you know, and this song becomes quite poignant and on our socials, anytime we kind of bring up Jeannie and Scotty, there will always be a comment about this song and how it reminds the people of these two. And Anne Spar comes in, or Dr. Bad News, as Scotty likes to call him. We find out that the pain medication's not working that well, so they've got to, you know, get in touch with Doug about that. But the last two donors that were a possible choice of matching didn't match. So they kind of have to go to square one, which is tough, isn't it? Because the choices sound horrendous.
There aren't many.
It's sort of last chance saloon here.
Yeah.
It's something that ER has been fantastic for teaching us, is that no, there isn't this unending supply, obviously, of blood before we covered that with Carter and Anna, And there isn't this unending supply of things like bone marrow and these kind of things that need donation. And obviously, how many times have we covered organ donation as well? Which on when you think about it, yeah, of course, completely obvious. Like, of course there wouldn't be. And they don't have this stuff sitting on ice. But then you always think, like, well, there's so many traumas every day. There's so many, like, unfortunately, there's so many people coding every single day that, oh, there must be. But I, speaking of someone who does not know the stats, I'm sure there are days when you only get type A positive blood for whatever reason, that just roll of the dice, you know, and then somebody's B. And it's like, sorry.
I never really knew how hard it is for the bone marrow match. That seems like an even more particularly even more difficult thing to get, because obviously, you know, not everybody's on any kind of system, so that the amount of people that would actually sign up to donate bone marrow is very small. We kind of see why a little bit with Anna's story this week, but you know, that pool is also very, very small, so there are moments where it's like, actually we don't have the thing that might help cure you. So the option is basically this hideous chemotherapy that could kill him.
And it's not even like you said, it's pure, was it phase one trial? It's like,
yes,
you know, like, this is like, hey Scotty, do you mind if we use you to just, you know, pump all the stuff into you, and hey, it might help. That's kind of not why we're doing this, though. Like, that's not why the scientists are doing it. It is absolutely why Jeannie and everyone will be doing this, but this is, again, roll of the dice. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, the guy doing the study will know that for next time.
Exactly. And Jeannie is really upbeat about it. She's very much like, it's fine, we've got these other trials, you know, we're going to try something else. And Anspar looks a little bit hesitant about it all at this point. And Jeannie says to Scotty, you know, she's really saying, like, this is, if it's a, this great option, and he should definitely try. And so he says, will you stay with me if I do it? And she says, well, of course. And then he agrees, which I think we all kind of know is more to do with her than him actually wanting to kind of do it. Well, because later Doug kind of comes up and he talks to him about pain meds, and he talks about this next round of chemo and how horrible it can be. And he figures it out quite quickly that Jeannie would, you know, that Jeannie's the big driver for Scott for doing this. And he goes and talks to Jeannie, which is, you know, this is a great moment. I think he's really good that he goes and he says to Jeannie, you know, think about this. I think he's got a crush on you, and I think he's just doing it for you, and you need to be aware of that. And makes her think, because I don't think she really factored that in. I think in her head, A, she really wants to obviously save him, and this is that path, so she's going to focus on that so much she might not see anything else around. But also, you know, I think she just thinks she's doing the best for him, and he, so she only sees that in him. She doesn't really see other factors around why he might have said yes or whatever.
It's like, in theory, doing anything to keep the patient alive, well, in theory, that's the job of being a doctor. Never mind, obviously, her personal connection to him. But like, that is the job of working in medicine, is to keep the patient alive. When I think looking after the best option of the patient might be a better way of looking at it. And it's so hard to be able to look at that dispassionately when you have a personal connection. And this kind of almost goes back to, you know, the Weaver Morgenstern discussion of a couple of weeks ago of like, do you ever think about them? And she's like, no. And I'm sure there are people who will make the argument that you can't, because you'd never get anything done.
Yeah. And something actually that ER really taught me as well was that sometimes you do come to the end of the road, and sometimes they, you know, you want to save people. Let's take Chase, for example. You know, if they did everything they could to save him and brought him back, but what's now his quality of life, and what, and that factors in a lot more than I realized. Because when you're younger, you kind of think, oh, doctors are there, they're going to save you no matter what or whatever. And actually, there are so many more questions, and there are moments where that is just not possible, or it is possible, but it's not ideal. Like the lung cancer patient we had, you know, whose life was just hideous, so bad, he couldn't live that anymore. So what is the point of saving him if his quality of life is going to be so hideous? So we have Jeannie come and kind of talk to Scotty, and she says to him, well, you know, should we call your friends? We haven't seen them for a while. And Scotty's just like, oh no, I don't want to call them. And I think that's when she really realizes, actually, I'm the only thing in his life, aren't I, at this present?
What does he say? They're just kids.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Scotty, this is not a criticism, but you're a kid too. And I don't mean to be heavy in this. It's like, try and enjoy being a kid while you can, which you would say to any child, as opposed to, you know.
You've got all life to be grown up. Be a kid when you can be a kid. And she has the talk with him, the proper talk about, well, no, she doesn't yet, does she? Sorry. We see her later because he crashes, doesn't he? It's horrible. And that's where we have that moment where the doctor says, you know, I wish parents could just learn to let these kids go, because again, you know, there really isn't anything that can be done, and it's just putting him under more suffering, and we don't know what the outcome will be. So when they kind of bring him back, that's when she talks to him and says to him, you know, I won't like you any less. You have to make this decision for yourself. Don't do this for me. And he finally says, I don't want the chemo, and they both cry, and it's...
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
It is just heartbreaking, yeah.
Keep talking about the blue Chrysler Viper. Cobalt blue, the white racing stripe. And it's just, and that's the heartbreaking thing to maybe get a bit heavy with it, is that it's that future that isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just that a child is dying. It's all of the potential.
Yeah.
It's
the adult that he was going to be. Yeah.
I knew the storyline was going to be hard, but it is.
It's really tough. So that's set that up, which is, sad. I think let's follow Doug through this week, because Doug has
a nice time.
He has a really good time, but I'm so mad about something, but we'll get there. We will get there. The first moment we see, so we hear about the fact that obviously, you know, Doug has put in this proposal about having kind of an attending paediatrician in the ER, and Weaver is dead set against it. She sees it very much as an attack on kind of her skills, and she says it's not necessary. You're acting like we can't do that job when we can. And this is, I get a bit, so Green is like, it's never going to happen. Don't worry about it. Like, don't bother fighting. Like, it's just not going to be a thing. And then literally the second later, we see Doug is arguing with the mom of a patient she can't stay. The patient's not well. The child's not well, but she can't stay because she's going to lose her job. And he basically takes the child off and says he's going to call the police if she goes anywhere, which I was not happy with, because I get what he's trying to do, but calling the police on a black woman is not
it was not a good look, was it?
Same as calling him, you know,
I got that too. It was so, again, I totally agree with you. Like, his reasoning, sure, was probably sound, but it's like, Doug, like, your heavy-handed approach to you can't use the same heavy, because he's used heavy-handed approaches from season one, but you can't do it for every single case.
No, have some awareness.
Exactly. Like, it's like read the room, but like, yes, she has to go, she's late for work, but there's always another way. Yeah. He effectively takes the child, again, it's all for good reasons, but he takes the child off her. And this is why, I mean, I don't think Carrie is being 100% when she says, I just don't think he's a good manager. I think there's obviously more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a point.
She does. I mean, she does say at this point, you know, and this guy wants to be an attending, you know, because these are the troubles he gets into. He gets very hot-headed and very, you know, my way is the only way. And he's not diplomatic, you know. And I think there is a moment in this whole thing where he could have worked with the mom and said, look, I'm really worried about this, this and this, but you need to get to work. What about you either come in later, or let me at least take the urine now and I'll give you a call. Or I don't know, I've seen moments where haven't they left the kid? There was a time when another parent left the child while they went and came back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Could that have been a solution? There were just other ways than just, I'm going to call the police on you. anyway, you know, he takes the child and he does the tests or whatever, which turned out to be he was right. And he goes to tell Mark and he says to Mark, see, you know, I was right. And Mark says to him, do you want me to call the mom? Which is really funny because he's basically saying, Doug, you're not diplomatic, isn't he? And that sits with Doug because he then talks to Carol about it. And Carol's like, no, you know, diplomatic does not come to mind when I think of you. I think about you being so, you know, stubborn. And she uses the word insouciant, which he doesn't know what it means, but it means to show kind of a casual lack of concern, which I think is definitely him at times. For all the will in the world, he does have some traits that aren't always the best in these moments. I think the thing that makes me really angry is that so the twins come in. Two twins come in. They're not well. Mark is having trouble. Well, they're having trouble treating one of them. They can't really get access to give the meds. They can't get the breathing tube in. And because Doug has a knowledge of children and he is well versed and well practiced in all of that, he knows a trick. So he gives the teachers green. Basically, he shows why his proposal may not be as bad as kind of Weaver and Green are making out, because there are some things that he knows that they don't, and which would come from being somebody who knows just children. Nobody's saying you can't treat children, but, you know, if there were expertise, like I would much prefer a Doug to be looking after my child or my whatever then, because he has those extra bits of knowledge, I guess. Because if Green was there alone, he wouldn't have known how to do the, you know, follow that bubble and do the, put their tube in and all that.
On paper, anyone can learn the mechanics of a human being, right? But there's something that obviously something that comes with experience. Like there's something that comes with personality as well, because someone who might have the medical knowledge to do something might not have the chutzpah to actually see it through or to try it. David Morgenstern. You know, it's things like this that stand for Doug. To be brutal about it, that's fantastic, that's great. He's going to be useless at admin,
and diplomacy and managing.
Mark is not great at that, and he's still a lot better than Doug is in terms of that side of things. Like, I think, God, it's almost like going, he gets the responsibility. But you know Kerry will still end up having to do some of that work, I think, if nothing changed.
He's a liability, isn't he? I think that's what would make me nervous. You know, he has hit patients' parents in the past, and he has literally just kidnapped a child from the mother and tried to call the police. He doesn't always go about things the right way. For me, I'd need some kind of real change, behavioural change, before I would feel comfortable signing off on him doing it. But I do agree with his proposal. I just think he needs to have a bit more maybe awareness, maybe look at what his weaknesses are and try and work on them. The thing I get mad about is we see Mark later. He's had that moment with the twins. Weaver comes up to him and says, I'm going to fight this. And Mark says, well, it's really difficult for me because I've literally just seen why Doug is probably right. And then she says, yes, you know, but it's undermining us and our work. And so he kind of says, all right, yeah, I'll back you. And then 2 seconds later, you know, Doug is with Kenesha Bevins, who's the girl from the morning, and he's blowing bubbles and, you know, she's doing well. And he called the mom up, he called the mom's work and sorted her job out, all the great stuff. And Mark, and he said, well, do you think I should go for it? And Mark says, yes. And that's where I get mad, because I'm like,
okay,
Mark, like, be honest. Because what you have done now is worse than saying to him, actually, I don't think you're ready, or actually, this is what it was about, what you do and why me and Weaver might worry. That's what it is. It's that real, I don't want confrontation. I don't want any of that. Because when Doug finds that out, that's going to rupture a friendship, because that is a real lack of trust moment. I can't trust you that you're telling me the truth.
Yeah. You know? It's appeasement, isn't it? Yeah. Like, he is Neville Chamberlain in this.
Wow.
And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's just, in an episode where Mark, God love him, comes across generally well as the kind of the bumbling, I just want to make a nice night for everyone. It's this, if he had held out a little firmer for either coming down harder on Doug's side or coming down harder on Kerry's side, yeah, it might sting now, but it's like ripping off a plaster.
Exactly that. I think at the end of the day, you would prefer as a friend when you look back, somebody who was honest with you from the beginning and said, actually, I didn't think it was a great idea. Then, you know, it would hurt at the time, but later you'd go, right, actually, that was better for me than somebody who's saying yes and you find out actually was not agreeing with it and actually working actively behind your back. I think that's where I got really mad, because look at Doug's face. He's so excited. And if you don't tell somebody where the faults are or what your worries are, how do you expect them to learn and grow? If you don't say to him, look, the thing that worries me about it, Doug, is that you can fly off the handle and you can do this. If you want to show me that you're going to be different, I'm backing you. Or say, actually, I don't think we need one for these reasons. But mark what he does here. It just makes me angry at him, because I'm like, you're putting pressure, you know, there's bad stuff's now going to happen in the future because of you. And that's not how you treat a friend.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you're absolutely right. Which is why Mark is dreadful and we need to remove him from his position in the hospital.
Right now.
Yeah.
Like, say what you want about Weaver, but she will tell you to your face.
Yes.
She's very fair.
And she will, you know, she will do that. And I think for me as a human, I prefer that to finding out later on somebody's done stuff behind your back or they didn't believe in you, but they didn't tell you that. Like, I have a real thing about people who can't, I don't know, I get it. I'm not the best at confrontation or difficult conversations, but I really respect when people know that and do it anyway. I really hate it when people are like, I'm not going to say anything because it's too hard, and they run off and cause more trouble. That's just my own personal thing. Carol Anna. So we've got that. So it opens with Carol getting all these new supplies.
Getting presents,
exciting. Everybody's like her little elves going out and kind of getting the boxes and stacking them for her. And you know, she thanks Carter. She says, Carter, it's from your grandmother. She basically gave us more money. It's great. We're going to do all this brilliant stuff. And she also asks Carter, so she's a real catalyst in the Carter Anna story, isn't she, this week? Because she says to Carter, oh, can I get a lift with you and Anna to the banquet? And Carter's like, I'm not going with Anna, because he's going with me. I'm not going with Anna.
I can't see any proof as to the opposite.
Exactly, thank you. And Carol says, oh, aren't you together? And he's like, no. And she's like, oh, I thought you were together. I thought I could sense some like chemistry. And I think for Carter, it really kind of makes him go, actually, you know, maybe this is now the moment that I need to make the move, because if other people are seeing it, then maybe it's not all in my head or whatever. So he asks Anna to the banquet and she says yes. Although it's not a confirmed date, because it could just be, let's go together. Yeah, we're friends, let's go together. Yes. But, you know, he did ask, and he does acknowledge that. He says to Carol later, you know, I've asked, but it might not be a date. She could be just going as friends, you know, don't read anything into it. And then Anna, we find out she basically, because she gave blood for the bone marrow kind of drive that they were doing, she's actually not, obviously she didn't match with Scotty, but she did match with somebody else. And they need to do the procedure today. Romano's like, yeah, yes, I can do it.
Did that feel a bit skeevy? Because I felt like he was kind of looking her up and down, like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because you have to drill into the bone.
Yeah, it's not exactly romantic.
There's easier ways to look at somebody's butt.
Ed knows. Experience. I found him really skeevy and really gross, and I can see why she kind of went for, you know, Carter, can you do it? Because I think you need somebody you can trust, yes, and that isn't going to come at you from that. I mean, because it's a tough procedure. And Ed, you've said it before about certain episodes or storylines that really stuck with you from the time. And this, for me, was one.
Oh, okay.
The whole bone marrow, what it actually takes. And, you know, and the way Romana said, you know, all that drilling, all those holes. Oh, sorry, it still sticks with me. It does not sound pleasant. So
no.
If you can, you want somebody you can trust. And
yeah.
So she asks Carter, which, you know, he's like, absolutely, you know, we'll do that. And oh gosh, sorry, it just makes me queasy, the whole storyline.
Yeah. Okay, let's skip past it.
Well, so Carter basically does do that, and they do have a moment where the thing kind of slips up. Well, it's a really sweet moment, the whole bit, because he's about to do the procedure, and she kind of shares with him the fact why she's so scared, and he's very like, you're scared, I've never seen you shot, or, you know, nervous. Yeah. And she talks about her tonsillectomy, which went really horribly. And then at one moment, kind of the thing, you know, the falls off, he can see her bum and he's kind of smiling, which is its own thing. She then says she's not going to come to the banquet because obviously she's just been drunk.
Understandable, yeah.
She's in pain. Mm. But she is there and she looks beautiful. She's wearing very... Yeah. Indian style clothes, which makes me think the earrings looked very Indian. The actual dress, it had like these paisleys, and it made me think that she tied me up, took my outfit off me. I'm in the bathroom screaming and no one can hear me, and she's off trying to take my man. Just putting that out there.
Sounds reasonable.
Thank you.
Yeah, that sounds completely plausible and not a bizarre fantasy at all.
And he says it to her. He basically says, you know, is this, we have a chemistry, is this a thing that we should be exploring? And she's very honest. She definitely feels it too, but she's still hung up on her ex. And he's like, the druggie, which I thought was so funny, you know, the way he basically is like, oh, the guy with the drug problem.
He just had to drop it in there. Yeah. I love that she didn't rise to that, because I think she sees that, right, okay, Carter, that obviously was what you meant it to be, but it's because you're smarting right now. And the chase of everything aside, it's, I have effectively just said, nah, bruh, you cool, we mates? You know, exactly. She said it nicely, but yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah,
he's, I wish, like, you wrote for ER. That would have been brilliant to see Anna say, nah, bruh, we're mates.
Well, actually, I'm going to hop in that wheelie bin TARDIS that was doing the rounds there on social media over the last few days and bring me back in time. Oh, I'll send you the link, Ed. I won't spoil any more than that. I'll just send you the link. It's okay. Yeah.
There's also another one that made me laugh a lot. Sorry, just to go off. Daniel Levy actually had put it up on Twitter, said we're all doing fine, and it looked like somewhere like Croydon or somewhere, but it's basically all these people are walking and the wind is just knocking them down and they're just walking and they're all just falling in the road. And sorry, it's not, but it does make me laugh.
It's kind of, okay, kind of like, I'm assuming everyone is not hurt here, everybody wins.
Yeah. So, you know, we get kind of an answer to that Anna and Carter thing. On the other hand, we have the Carol and Carter storyline, which is, you know, so we see her getting the supplies. She says, your grandmother gave me more money. Later, we see her on a phone call saying, actually, she's taken the money off me. Do you know why? And at first, Carter thinks it might be the publicity around the, you know, the birth control. And then it clicks with him. Actually, it's Chase. It's because of him. So he says to Carol, look, it's not you. It's something, I need to go and talk to her.
Mm.
And we get that scene between him and, you know, him and Gamma, where they both kind of air out their grievances. And he says, you've done this because of Chase. But you have to understand that Chase did not want to tell anybody, and he did not even want to tell me. And don't punish me kind of for that.
Yeah.
But then on Gamma, on the other side, is, well, don't punish me for being this person who's given you money and given you your life, which I get. I can see, again, both sides.
Yeah, you sort of say, she says, you live on a family trust.
Yeah,
he doesn't need to work, probably.
Yeah, it's sort of, I most certainly do not live in a family trust, but I suppose it's that final ammunition, isn't it? It's the bookend to any argument. You could have the most impassioned, completely legitimate argument for whatever the case is. And at the end, it's like, yeah, but I pay your lighting and I pay your heating bill. And it's the kind of the very stereotypical, you know, once you live under my roof, you will adapt, you will follow my rules. I say stereotypical because obviously there's more to it than that.
It's the danger of giving money to family or friends. I'm just thinking about that Community episode where Piers gives Annie money and then in return gets a better role in the drug.
Yeah, makes his part bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it doesn't even make sense. Yeah, exactly that. It's that, you know, I now control you and you can't turn around, because that's what comes with the money. It's not just here's some money, I want to help you, or here's money because you'll be a part of a rich family. It's, well, then you now have a certain code that you have to behave in. And I think that for me is, I think I'm a bit like Carter, you know, he basically says, well, fine, I don't want it, because that's how I think I would be too, a bit like, oh God, if that's the way, that's what it's going to cost me, you know, I just don't want to be told how to live my life.
Yeah.
I was there thinking as he was walking out the room, I was like, Carter, you don't get paid for your job.
I thought that, but this is not going to end well.
Yeah. It will have repercussions, I imagine.
Yes.
But, you know, he's done it. He's basically cut the strings, the apron strings off, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
It's a big deal for us. It's that ongoing sort of theory we've got that ER is the story of Carter in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah,
it is.
And this is a major thing that he's, as you say, he's no longer John Carter of the Carter family. He's a man in his own right, which he needed to do. It would have happened sometime. Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. I think, and isn't that what growing up kind of is in a way, you know, you kill your parents in a way because you need to make your own way. So you don't want to just be their disciple or whatever they tell you to be. It's like finding out who you are and living your life on your terms. And he's doing this that quite literally in this moment.
Yeah.
With his gamma.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For sure. And I think she respects him because she sends more money for the clinic.
Yeah, like she's able to be like, I mean, There is a nugget of having a point in, look, bad press.
Yeah.
You know, so, but obviously we know that's not the reason. It's a good excuse, but it's not the reason. And she's able to go, right, no, okay, perceived punishment to the perceived guilty party here. This is not the clinic. This is not Carol. It could even be, because we don't know what conversations have been had since Chase has gone into the care home.
Yeah.
So, perhaps they haven't had a conversation about anything at all. Maybe this was a way of forcing him to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's the one string she kind of has, isn't it, to kind of pull to get him back or to get a reaction or whatever. But she then realizes actually it wasn't ever really about that, the birth control thing, and I've been unfair. And she gives she reinstates the money, which we find out at the banquet when Carol's like, yeah, we got the money back.
Yeah.
Because Carter goes to apologize, doesn't he? I'm sorry, I couldn't help. And he's like, no, it's fine, it's all sorted. Which again is another great moment, because Carol was trying to look at mortgaging her house.
Yeah.
Remortgaging her house or getting a loan out on it. And Doug's like, yeah, you're being crazy, which I thought was a funny moment, but it just shows her commitment, doesn't it? And
yeah.
Doug was there, gives her a kiss, smiles her, doesn't offer to help. This was noticed, Douglas.
Yes.
He's still paying for that lad's treatment up
exactly
in the snowy from a couple of years ago.
And he doesn't get a lot of money, as we've learned as well.
Yeah.
And he's kind of in a freelancy ways, and he's kind of dependent on them, fellow, rather than, oh, this is a steady paycheck that I can put aside to save for things. But there you go. I think that's the episode.
I think it is.
A couple of things I want to mention. So we see Alison, patient who had the and she's come back and she's got a job as an EMT, and all appearances she's doing really well at it, and it's funny hearing her voice, you know, but it's great as well, and she's clearly in control of us, you know, she's doing really well. It's very gratifying.
I loved that as well. You've got Corday beaming at her as well.
Yeah.
You know, because her voice is basically her command in that moment. She's telling them exactly what's going on. Yeah. So you see a real direct link. And Corday's pride is just the best. But yeah.
Yeah. But also, I knew this anyway, but I'm still surprised that Benton is still a resident. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he feels like he's been there long enough that he should be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because there's a weird relationship with time in ER, because sometimes we're told weeks have passed between episodes, and I'm just like, you know what, did Benton fail a bunch of exams or something?
He's just still a resident.
Maybe it's different in surgery.
I think it is.
Yeah. Maybe it's harder because he's black and they're just trying to keep him down.
Pricks.
Well, I mean, if it's Romano, it probably is that.
Yeah. It's maybe it's become militant. So so I think that is the episode. Any Ibers? I didn't get any myself.
Oh, nope. Yes. I have one. Yeah. Robert Ellenstein, who was the pathology case.
Swanee.
What well, was a very important person, Edward. Edward, did you not recognize Robert Ellenstein? The president of the United Federation of Planets in Star Trek IV, the one with the whales.
Even I did not know.
No.
That's him. That is him. And he also appeared in one episode of The Next Generation as well as the father of Robert Nepper, who was Deanna Troi's betrothed marriage all the way back in season one. He was, he and played. Robert yeah, Nepper and Robert Nepper,
in,
of course.
Was in
the episode yeah. previously. We, yeah.
Episode?
He was all strapped up on the. Yeah, it was.
He was, and actually, I have to say, when I first saw him and he was talking, I was like, "Is that Rob Reiner?" Just for a second, I was like,
"Understandable, yeah.
Yeah. And then later, when they've shown him a bit more, I was like, "No, it's not Rob Reiner." But I was like, "Is that Rob Reiner?"
He was strapped to the table. How could I possibly recognize?
To be fair, no, I recognized the name. Just I've only just done a deep dive on The One with the Whales, so
I watched it.
So that's why.
Yes. But yeah, so that's why he was relatively fresh in my mind as he died. And of course, we've said her before, but Megan Cole, who was, of course, running the Senator Kreetak.
Love her.
Kimura Kreetak, yeah.
Yeah.
With her deep voice.
Yes, I love her.
So I thought we'd do some anatomy because I've skimped on your lessons lately and I apologise.
It's true, we are falling behind.
Four people have died, Ed. We need these lessons.
You're going derp, 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 don't know what drugs to give them.
Exactly.
So they keep talking about bone marrow, so I thought I'd talk about bone because I didn't know much. I knew that it was affected by leukemia, I knew it was something to do with cells, that kind of thing. I don't know about you guys, particularly known much.
No.
Nope.
No.
So bone marrow is basically found in the centre of bones.
Which is why they have to drill.
Oh, no, okay. You. Is this, do you mean to be quick
no,
on
no,
this?
You carry on. I'm just saying that's the, okay. You know, the idea of that is just, it's just stayed with me.
If you faint, then we'll just skip to the end. Yeah.
Or just carry on and I'll wake up at some point.
We'll revive you.
If you occasionally hear a click, that was us muting the mic.
So basically, yeah, it's found in the center of our bones and it's split generally into red or yellow marrow.
Red marrow, so, yellow marrow, red marrow. Sorry.
Oh my god. It changes over time as well. So when a baby's born, it's mostly red marrow, which produces mostly your red blood cells, and then yellow marrow is more of your immune system cells, your white blood cells. And in adults, it's found red marrow is found mainly in the central skeleton. So that's your pelvis, sternum, cranium, ribs, vertebrae, and scapulae. Your collarbones. Also, it can switch back. So in circumstances of chronic hypoxia, so where the body's starved of oxygen for a long time, the body will convert yellow marrow back to red marrow to increase blood cell production to keep amazing. The body going. Yeah, I know.
I love stuff like that. Our bodies are so cool. Sorry.
I know.
Yeah.
But thank God, literally. Yes. Yeah, so it also, human marrow produces approximately 500 billion blood cells per day.
Jesus, so that's quite sorry, I was like, for some reason that number took a second to pop into my head.
I was like, yeah, I know, I saw it and I was like, "Bo." So yeah, it's crazy and it can be affected by all sorts of disease and issues. So it can be damaged or displaced by aplastic anemia, myeloma, tuberculosis as well, and exposure to radiation or chemotherapy can kill many of the rapidly dividing cells of the bone marrow and results in a depressed immune system. So people who have chemo are more susceptible, like poor old Scotty, are more susceptible to infection. And my brother had stem cell and chemo, and he was like Scotty, he was bubble boy. He had to basically not see anybody for fear of any minor infection. It was crazy. Didn't stop him going to the pub at Christmas, but no, he's all right now. And the earliest fossilized evidence of bone marrow was discovered in 2014 in Eusthenopterin, which is one of the it's one of the fish on the way to being a four-legged walking creature from 370 million years ago. So
Wow.
That's bone marrow. I hope that was intriguing.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Learning good. Something new.
I hope you made notes. I will be testing you next week.
Okay. Excellent. Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Okay, and on that strange note, we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget you can find us on social media, on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at Set_Pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.